It's more like a sortie in the battle between Dao's wives. I didn't want to think about Crystal, whose history with men had been a series of disasters. She'd gotten pregnant by one guy and apparently been left to raise the child on her own. She'd had one husband who abused her and another who looked oh so respectable on the surface, but in fact drank too much and had a peculiar bent in bed. Clint was in his early 40s, a good-looking guy, big and well-built. He didn't seem that bright, but he had enormous patience with his clients, whose struggles with fitness were both diligent and short-lived. The last time I remembered seeing him was just after New Year's, when a new batch of converts arrived at the gym, whipped into a frenzy of repentance after the holiday indulgences. His clientele was literally always heaviest around that time. Crystal had way too much class to dally with the likes of him. On the other hand, she was only one marriage away from life as a stripper, and as slick as she seemed, she probably wasn't a whole lot smarter than he. In love, as in other matters, people end up seeking their own level. I adjusted my rear-view mirror, ever mindful of Tommy Heavener. Just because I didn't see him didn't mean he wasn't there. I could feel my bowels squeeze down every time I thought of him. By 6:25, I decided Crystal wasn't going to show. I'd already started my car when a white Volvo turned the corner of Missile and headed in my direction. She was at the wheel. Chapter 23. I killed the engine and sat, watching as she slowed and pulled into the drive. I grabbed my umbrella and got out of the car as she was getting out of hers. This was one of those occasions where asking a direct question seemed the obvious route. I wasn't going to lurk in the bushes or peep over windowsills in search of the truth. Crystal? She'd already let herself through the gate and she turned to look at me. She wore a rain-repellent parka, cowboy boots, tight jeans, a heavy white cable-knit sweater. She clutched a neat stack of shirts against her body to protect them from the damp. Her makeup was light, and her tousled blonde hair was pulled into a knot. She stood with one hand on the latch, and I could see her puzzlement. "Can I talk to you for a minute?" Her response time was ever so faintly slow. "About what?" "Clint. We happen to be members of the same fitness gym." "What do you want?" I shook my head. "Someone saw your car here and thought you might show up again." She closed her eyes and then opened them again. "Fiona." I didn't cop to it outright, but I didn't see much reason to deny it either. What was the point? She knew I'd been working for Fiona, and who else, really, would be dogging her steps? "You should probably be aware she talked to Detective Paglia." "Fuck. She just can't leave anything alone. What's she going to do? Monitor my actions for the rest of my life? Have me followed around so she can point a finger at me? What I do with my time is none of her damn business." "Hey, babe, it wasn't my idea. If you're pissed off, take it up with her." "Oh, right." She paused while she struggled to get a grip on herself. When she spoke again, her tone was more resigned than angry. "Let's get out of the rain. It's ridiculous to stand here getting soaked." I followed her through the gate. We went up the front steps and took shelter on the porch. I lowered my umbrella, pausing to shake off the water. "I guess there's no point pretending you didn't see me today. I don't like it any more than you do. You know, the entire time I was married to Dao, she did everything she could to make life miserable for me. How much more shit am I supposed to take?"
She's not the only one who heard the rumor about Clint.
"Who'd she get that from? Dana Glazer, no doubt. Oh, what an evil bitch she is. People talk about these things. Sooner or later, it was bound to come out. Oh, for pity's sake. You know what? There's no law that says I can't visit a friend, so why don't you go back and tell her to get fucked?"
She gestured dismissively, annoyed with herself.
"Skip that," she said. "Why add fuel to the fire? Clint was my trainer. We did weights. End of sentence. There was never anything sexual between us. Ask him if you doubt me. I'll be happy to wait out here."
What would that prove?
I'm sure he's too much of a gentleman to kiss and tell. "Don't you have any male friends?
Does everything between a man and a woman have to be sexual? I didn't say you were guilty of anything. I'm telling you how it looks. Tongues have been wagging. Fiona saw your car here yesterday, and here you are again today. She stared at me briefly and then seemed to make a decision. Why don't you come in and I'll introduce you properly? Why would I do that? Why not? As long as you've come this far. By the way, I found Dow's passport when I was going through his clothes. It was still in the breast pocket of the overcoat he wore when we went to Europe last fall. Well, that's one question down. Are those his? I said, pointing to the shirts. Someone might as well get some use out of them. She unlocked the front door, using a key, I noticed, from her own keychain. She pushed open the door and stepped aside, allowing me to pass in front of her and into the house. I don't know why I should have felt embarrassed, but I did. The front room was done up as an old-fashioned parlor, with a camelback sofa, occasional tables, and assorted Queen Anne chairs. Every item of furniture sported a hand-crocheted doily, designed as protection from dirt and grease stains. There was a grandfather clock and lots of knick-knacks, milk glass, cranberry glass, Steuben glass, Yadro, framed photographs of family members long since deceased. Crystal scarcely gave the room a glance as she proceeded down the hallway and through the kitchen to a glassed-in porch. Clint was seated in a lazy boy looking out toward the yard. She put the stack of shirts on a small wooden table next to him. Crystal gave him a brief kiss on the top of his head. I brought you some shirts, and I also brought a friend. You remember Kinsey. She's a member of your gym. At first I thought, not Clint. Mistake. Has to be someone else. But it was him. Whatever his disability, he was considerably diminished. He was suffering contractures of his hands, and a muscle weakness so pronounced that he could hardly move his head. He'd lost an enormous amount of weight. His eye sockets were puffy, a reddish-purple color, as though he'd been punched out. I could see skin lesions on his forehead and his arms. I tuned the rest of it out. Through the window, I could see a burly old guy working in the yard, tying up some vines. Probably Clint's father, the man who answered the phone. Crystal was saying, we just ran into each other, and she was asking about you. How are you doing? I said, feeling like a fool. Clearly, he wasn't doing well and might never do well again. Clint has a systemic connective tissue disease called dermatomyositis. Severe, in his case. It may be an autoimmune reaction, though nobody really knows. This has been going on since, what, the end of January, isn't it? She addressed her remarks to him as though for confirmation. The doctors were hoping he'd go into remission, so it seemed advisable for him to lay low. Is that why he rented the Glazer's cottage? That's right. I wanted him close so I could keep an eye on him. After the lease ran out, it seemed best to have him move in with his parents for a while. She leaned closer to him. Where'd your mom go? Is she out? Clint's response was garbled, but she seemed to understand him. Probably because she'd tracked his degenerating speech patterns for the past 10 months. Why didn't you let people know what was going on? Clint asked me not to, and I honored his request. As long as you're prying, will there be anything else? I'll have to tell Fiona. Of course, she said. That's what she pays you for. I'm surprised you'd even mention it. It might go a long way to getting her off your back. Crystal smiled at Clint, who was watching her with a dog-like devotion. Cat's out of the bag, she said. Remember Dow's ex-wife? She finally figured out we were having a torrid love affair. Kinsey has caught us in the act. I could feel myself flush. Clint seemed to enjoy the joke, and I could hardly protest. I said, I probably ought to go. Good. He gets tired when we have visitors. I'll walk you to the door. I could feel a brittle rage radiating from her as she accompanied me. I knew she resented the invasion of privacy, both his and hers. Look, I'm sorry. Forget it. Did Dow know? Someone else might have told him. I certainly didn't. People want to believe the worst. That's the hell of it, she said. The freeway traffic was crawling, cars end to end, apparently slowed by an accident farther up the road. I drove home on surface streets to avoid the mess. All the street lamps were on and the roads gleamed like patent leather in the falling rain. In my neighborhood, the houses glowed with light. I found parking right in front of Henry's. I was grateful for that, as it saved me the half block of splashing through puddles. I went through the squeaking gate and around the corner of my studio to the rear. Henry's kitchen lights were out. He was probably over at Rosie's, where I'd catch up with him in a bit. I unlocked my door and let myself in. As I closed the door behind me, someone slammed against it from the outside and sent me hurtling. My shoulder bag struck the floor with a thunk, and I saw my key ring sail off and land on the rug. I went sprawling, hands flying out instinctively to catch myself. I hit the floor and rolled as Tommy Hevener grabbed me by the hair, pulled me upright, and dragged me backward. I stumbled into him, and he sat down abruptly, pinning me across his knees. I'd been flipped like a turtle, and I was on my back, flailing for purchase. His raincoat was in a tangle, but offered enough protection that I couldn't land a blow. He choked me with one hand while he squeezed his fingers around my face, digging into my jaw so hard it forced my mouth open. He stuck his face against mine. I could feel his breath against my mouth. Henry gave you the name of a jeweler in L.A. Turns out there isn't any such guy. So what the fuck was that about? The door swung open again and banged once against the wall. I shrieked, rolling my eyes in that direction. Richard was standing in the doorway in his black raincoat. He closed the door behind him, looking on with indifference as Tommy tightened his grip. Answer me. I don't know. I never dealt with him. Someone told Henry. He was just passing it on. You were there. No. He shook my head, using my hair for leverage. I clawed at his hand, trying to pry his fingers off. The pain was excruciating. Let go! Let go! That's it. That's all. I never called the guy, I swear. Tell me you didn't find the safe and help yourself. What safe? The fucking safe in the office. Don't play dumb. You know exactly what I mean. You broke in, you ripped us off, and we want the stuff back. What stuff? I don't even know what you're talking about. Richard said, get her up. Tommy didn't move. His grip on my hair was so tight, I thought he'd tear out a hunk of my scalp. I couldn't move my head. I was nearly sick with fear. What had Mariah done? Had she set me up? Richard said, Tommy. Grudgingly, Tommy loosened his grip. I turned on my side and rolled away from him. I lifted myself as far as my hands and knees, shaking my head while I gasped for breath. I don't know anything about a safe. I never saw it. I put one hand against my throat, trying to suck down air. I'd have to be an idiot to break in. I still have a key. It's on my key ring. I fumbled across the rug for my keys and held them up to him. Look at this. Think about it. If I'd done it, I'd have closed the place so you wouldn't know. Why would I leave it open and call attention to the break-in? How'd you know the place was left open? Richard asked. He seemed calmer than Tommy, but no less dangerous. He took the ring of keys and sorted through them until he found the office key, which he worked out of the bunch. He tossed the remaining keys to Tommy. I directed my response to both, looking from one to the other. Because my office is right there, across the alleyway. Richard was silent, and I felt myself babbling on. I'm telling you the truth. Last night I stopped at the office. I looked across the alley and saw the door standing open.
What time?
7, I think, sometime around then. Tommy said, why didn't you call the cops? I thought it was Richard and he was showing the place. Tommy was sitting with his knees drawn up, shaking his head. Jesus! You don't know how much trouble we're in. Christ, everything is gone. Every goddamn...
Shut up, Tommy. She doesn't need to know. Let's get her out of here before someone shows up.
I'm sorry your valuables were stolen, but it wasn't me, I swear. Yeah, well, we're sunk anyway, wiped out. It's over.
Knock it off, Richard said and hauled me to my feet. You take her, I'll drive. I'll drive, it's my truck.
Right. Richard locked his arms around me, pinning my arms against my body.
He lifted me off the floor and walked me to the door, half dragging me, half carrying. I grabbed the door frame long enough to get my feet down. I stiffened my knees, forcing him to halt. "Let me get my bag," I said, gesturing. I felt like a kid pleading for her teddy bear. Tommy leaned down and picked up my shoulder bag. He did a quick search, pawing through the contents. He found the Davis, checked the load, and tucked it in his pocket, tossing the bag aside. There went that hope. I glanced back, watching him turn the lights out and pull the door shut before he joined us on the patio. His truck was parked around the corner. Richard held my left arm, his fingers digging into me so hard I knew I'd bruise. The two of them crowded against me, walking in a lockstep that forced me to trot along. What were they going to do with me? Rape, maim, and kill? What would be the point of that? If they took me to the house, I could scream my bloody head off and no one would hear. We reached the pickup truck. Richard opened the door on the passenger side. He flipped the seat forward and shoved me into the narrow space behind the seats, knocking my head against the frame in the process. I said, "Hey!" This was pissing me off. I managed to rub my head while I squeezed into the well. Tommy got in on the driver's side. The two doors slammed in quick succession like rifle shots. Tommy jammed the key in the ignition and the engine fired to life. He pulled out with a chirp that probably left a little skid of rubber on the pavement. I clung to the seat back, trying to assess the situation. For the moment, I was safe. Tommy was too busy driving to pay attention to me, and Richard didn't have a sufficient angle to turn around and level more abuse. Rain was stinging against the windshield. Tommy flipped on the wipers. I said, "Where'd you have the safe? The place always looked empty to me." Tommy said, "In the closet floor, under the wall-to-wall carpeting." "Don't play dumb." Richard was bored. "How many people knew besides the two of you?" Tommy said, "No one." Richard snorted. "What's this, 20 questions? Would you give it a rest?" "Who opened it last?" "Jesus, Tommy, this is bullshit. Are you buying this act?" "He did. We had something we wanted to sell. He goes all the way down to Los Angeles on Friday, and there isn't any such dude. He thought I pulled a fast one, and he was pissed." "When did he get back? Was it late?" "No, it wasn't late," Richard snapped, exasperated. "It's 5 o'clock. I go over to the office and put the piece back in the safe." "Everything else was still there?" "Of course it was. Now would you shut the fuck up?" "Maybe someone saw you with the stuff and followed you back. If they saw where the safe was hidden, they could have waited until you left and ripped you off." "I said shut your mouth!" He raised his left arm, torqued around in the seat, and bashed me in the face with a backhanded swing. The blow didn't have much force, but it hurt like a son of a bitch. I felt tears burn my eyes. I put my hands across my nose, hoping he hadn't broken it. Didn't feel like that. Tommy said, "Hey, cut it out! Who put you in charge? Just leave her alone." "Why? Because you're fucking her?" "He is not. Who wants to be accused of screwing some guy you can barely tolerate?" There was a moment of silence, then I said, "Anyway, how'd they get the safe open? Was it drilled?" "You're just not gonna shut up, are you?" I thought the question was a good one, but I shut my mouth and leaned away from the front seat, out of range. The space where I was sitting was small and cramped, scratchy with cheap carpeting. I groped around, hoping for a weapon, a wrench, or a screwdriver, but found nothing. I felt along the circumference of the well, and my fingers closed over a ballpoint. I didn't think it'd be effective, but then again, why not? I clutched the pen in my fist, wondering what would happen if I jammed it in Richard's ear. The drive to the house took 7 minutes at top speed on the wet, slick roads that wound through Horton Ravine. I held on for dear life, the turns throwing me first this way and then that. As Tommy wheeled up the driveway, he picked up the remote control for the two double-wide garage doors and hit one of the buttons. The double door on the left began to roll open, and a light came on. He pulled in, coasted to a stop, and set the handbrake. The adjacent bay was empty.
Tommy's red Porsche sat in the next bay over, and on the other side of that was a second Porsche, a shiny black one, presumably Richard's. Richard opened the door and got out. He left the truck door ajar. I could see the two big garbage cans just outside the kitchen door where they tossed their trash. Above them, I could see a line of buttons on the wall. I thought he meant to hit one so the garage door would grind shut, but he peered into the truck bed. He opened the toolbox and fumbled among the contents. I measured the distance, but I wasn't going to have time enough to lean forward, pull the door shut, and lock it before he got to me. I turned to Tommy. You were at my house last night. I saw someone in the office when I stopped off on my way home. You couldn't have stolen anything and then showed up at my place so soon afterward. He turned to look at me. What? If it wasn't you, it was him. Who else knew the combination? Just the two of you, right? Richard came back with a coil of rope. Nobody asked you. Now get out. Tommy, think about it. Please. Tommy sat there for a moment. He got out of the truck and moved around the front to the passenger side. Richard, what are we doing? This is dumb. We should have left her where she was. She doesn't know anything. Richard scarcely looked at him. Back off. I'll take care of it. Who put you in charge? What the hell is that for? I'm going to tie her up and kick the shit out of her until she tells us where she hid the stuff. You're not thinking straight. Who asked you? Richard said. I told you not to fuck with her. This is all your fault. Oh, really? Now it's my fault, Tommy said. His annoyance had passed, and there was something new in his face. He put his hand in his coat pocket. I knew he'd put the gun in one pocket, but I couldn't remember which. You know, she's got a point. I know where I was last night, and I can prove it because of her. How do I know you didn't clean out the safe yourself? Richard snorted. Why would I do that? I don't have anyone to lay it off on, if you'll remember. You say that now. You could have taken everything to L.A. when you went on Friday. You could have sold it all and kept the money. Then come back here and made it look like a burglary. There's only your word you put it back where it was. I never saw the jewelry after you came back. That's bullshit. I'll give you bullshit. The safe wasn't drilled. Somebody had the fucking combination. There are only two of us who knew. I know it wasn't me, so that leaves you. Stick it up your ass, Richard said. He put his hand on the seat back so he could reach for me. I leaned forward and swung the pen in an arc and brought it down hard on the back of his hand. Richard bellowed with rage. He tried to grab me, but I scooted back to the driver's side of the truck. Enraged, he flipped the seat forward, prepared to haul me out. I braced myself and kicked twice at his hand. I caught him smartly with the heel of my socony, jamming three of his fingers. Fuck! He pulled his hand back, flashing a furious look at Tommy. Jesus, Tommy, help me out here! Answer my question. Don't be an idiot. I didn't take anything. Now let's get her out of here. You and I were the only ones who knew. Fuck this burglar shit. There wasn't any burglar. Richard slammed the passenger side door. All right, you shit. I'm telling you the truth. I didn't do it. You get that? I wouldn't do that to you, but you'd do that to me because you've done it before. So how do I know it wasn't you? I didn't open the safe. You did that, Richard. You made a point of going down to L.A. alone. The jewelry's gone now, you. Richard flew forward and grabbed Tommy by the front of his coat. He pulled him forward and then shoved. Tommy stumbled but regained his footing and came back at him. I saw Richard's fist fly out, catching Tommy in the mouth. He went down, tumbling backward into the two plastic garbage cans that shot apart like bowling pins. I leaned down and reached around the side of the seat, fumbling for the lever that would release the seat back. I felt the lock give way. I opened the door on the driver's side. I slithered through the gap, crouched, and came up along the fender, still in a crouch. I could hear the chilling sound of flesh on flesh, a grunt as someone took the brunt of a blow. I lifted my head. Tommy was dragging himself to his feet, trying to free the Davis from his raincoat pocket. His legs seemed to weaken under him, and he went down. There was blood streaming from his nose. He moaned, looking up at his brother in a daze. Richard kicked him. He bent down and took the gun from Tommy's rubbery grip. He stepped back, leveled the Davis at his brother.
Almost lazily, Tommy put a hand up and said, "Oh, Richie, don't."
Richard fired. The bullet tore into Tommy's chest, though the blood was slow to come.
Richard looked blankly at his brother's body and nudged him with his foot.
"Serves you right, you little shit. Don't accuse me."
He tossed the gun aside. I heard it clatter across the garage floor and skitter under the truck. He hit the button that activated the other garage door. His manner was matter-of-fact as he moved around the red Porsche to the black one and got in. He started the car and put it in reverse, engine whining. He backed out of the garage and down the drive. I scrambled around the front of the truck on my hands and knees. I crawled over to Tommy to check his pulse. But he was dead. I spotted the gun. I was just about to pick it up when I caught myself. My hand veered off abruptly like an airplane pilot aborting a landing. No way would I mar the fingerprints that Richard left on the gun. I got up, went through the back door, turning the deadbolt behind me as I headed for the phone. I was feeling cold with dread, worried Richard would turn around and come back for me. I dialed 911 and told the dispatcher about the shooting. I explained who the shooter was, gave her his name, a description of his Porsche, and his license number. HEVNER1. I recited the address in Horton Ravine, repeating everything twice. She told me to remain at the scene until the officers arrived. I said, "Sure," and hung up. After that, I dialed Lonnie.
Chapter 24. I finally crawled into bed at midnight. Detectives Paglia and Odessa arrived at the Heveners shortly after Lonnie showed up, and they had at least pretended to be sympathetic as they talked me through the events leading up to Tommy's death. They viewed me as a witness, not a suspect, which greatly affected their handling of me. Lonnie rode herd on them, nonetheless, protecting my rights any time he thought they were crossing the line in the course of the interview. The crime scene investigation seemed to take forever. Fingerprints, sketches, and photographs. The endless narrative loop in which I laid it all out again in excruciating detail. They bagged and tagged the Davis as evidence. It would probably be a year before I saw that gun again. Richard Heveners was picked up within the hour, driving south on the 101 on his way to Los Angeles. I figured it was still remotely possible he'd taken the jewelry, but I was not convinced. Lonnie was the one who drove me home. Monday morning, I skipped the run and then I skipped the gym. I was feeling cranky and sore, my body a patchwork of bruises. Emotionally, I was feeling battered as well. I drove to the office and circled the block, finally finding a parking spot about 6 blocks away. I hobbled the distance and took the elevator up. When I walked into the firm, Jennifer was sitting at her desk, applying a final coat of polish to her fingernails. For once, Ida Ruth and Jill didn't seem interested in persecuting her. I found the two of them chatting in the corridor. At the sight of me, they fell silent and fixed me with compassionate looks. Jill said,
"Coffee's on and back. Shall I bring you a mug?"
I'd appreciate that. I went into my office and dialed Fiona's number. When she answered the phone, we exchanged the obligatory chit-chat. I was guessing she hadn't heard about the shooting because she never mentioned it. Or maybe she didn't care. That was always a possibility with her. In the background, I could hear metal banging, the scraping of chairs, and assorted shrieks. Blanche's 4 rowdy kids spending the day at Grandma's. With Fiona's bare cement floors, it sounded like a roller rink or bumper cars. I said, "I have the answer to your question about that person living in that house on Bay. Turns out it's Clint Augustine's father, and Clint's living with him.
I told you they were having an affair."
"Well, not quite." Jill appeared and set a mug of coffee on my desk. I blew her a kiss and went on to describe Clint's medical condition, which I gave Fiona by name. I read about dermatomyositis in the Merck manual I have sitting on my desk at home. Altogether, not good.
and his particular symptoms seemed severe. I'm guessing that in the last year he's been in no shape to engage in a sexual liaison, or any other kind for that matter. I found it a relief to be talking about something other than the night before. Fiona's response was grudging. Perhaps I've misjudged her. Hard to know, I said, not wanting to rub it in. What about the missing money? The cops are looking into it, so I'll leave that to them. I won't be charging for the time I put in. She seemed to shake off her disappointment. Well, I suppose that takes care of business. If you like, you can calculate what I owe you and deduct it from the balance of the retainer. No need for a final report. This call will suffice. Sure, I can do that. I'll put a check in the mail to you this afternoon. There was a moment's hesitation. I wonder if I could ask you to bring me that in cash. Sure, no problem. I can have it up there this afternoon. I was sitting at my desk cleaning and organizing my files when Jennifer came in and handed me a note. Kinsey, sorry I had to do that to you, but I didn't have a choice. Here's the difference between us. Basically, you're decent and have a conscience. I don't. Mariah. Where'd you get this?
It was just sitting on my desk.
Feeling sick, I lifted the receiver and dialed 713, the Houston, Texas area code, and then 555-1212 for directory assistance. When the operator came on, I asked her for the sheriff's department in the county where Hatchet was located. She gave me the number, and I made a note of it. I let it sit on my desk while I took out the file Mariah Talbot had given me. I glanced through the news clippings until I spotted the name of the sheriff who'd handled the Heavener murder case. I tried Mariah's number first and got the same recorded message I'd heard before.
Hello, this is Mariah Talbot. You've reached the offices of Guardian Casualty Insurance in Houston, Texas.
I depressed the plunger. Anyone could leave a recorded announcement on an answering machine. Anyone can have a stack of business cards printed. I dialed the Texas number and asked for Sheriff Hollis Cayo. I identified myself and told him where I was calling from. I'm wondering about two murders you investigated in 1983. This was Jared and Brenda Heavener.
Oh, I remember them, he said. They were both fine people and deserved better than they got. How can I help?
I thought I should pass along some information. Tommy Heavener died last night. His brother shot him in the heat of an argument. There was a moment of quiet while he took that in.
I can't say I'm surprised. I hope you're not telling me Richard's headed this way.
No, no. The cops picked him up and put him in the county jail out here. I understand he's broke, so the public defender's office will probably handle the case, I said. One thing I was wondering, was Casey Stonehart ever caught?
No, ma'am. He's gone, disappeared right after the murders. Probably the work of them two boys as well. Our best guess is he's dead, but we may never know. Texas is a big state. A lot of acreage available for unmarked graves.
I understand Brenda Heavener's sister and Guardian Casualty Insurance intend to file suit. Have you heard about that?
Yes, ma'am. I believe they're in the process of gathering information, even as we speak. What's your interest?
I had an insurance investigator come into my office a week ago, and I wondered if you knew her. This is a woman named Mariah Talbot. I could hear the smile in his voice.
Yeah, we know her. Mariah the Pariah. You're talking 5'9", 140 pounds, 26 years old, blue eyes, and her hair's turned prematurely gray.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I was beginning to think she'd misrepresented herself. How long has she worked for Guardian Casualty?
I never said she did. Fact is, Talbot's the name of Casey's older brother. Got another one named Flynn. I think there's another couple brothers in there somewhere, but those are the two I dealt with. The fact is, that whole family's bad. In jail and out, a bunch of sociopaths.
I could feel myself squint. And what's her connection?
The woman you're talking about is Casey's sister, Mariah Stonehart, the only girl.
I said, ah. After we hung up, I laid my little head down on the desk. I should have known, I guess, but there was no doubt about it. She was slick. At 10:30, I went over to the courthouse to do a records check for Tina Bart. I figured it would be a comfort to bury myself in endless mundane paperwork, where the chances of violence and betrayal were reduced to a minimum. Besides, I was genuinely curious about Glazer's business dealings, specifically his connection to Genesis Financial Management Services. The MFCU investigator was probably tracking the three larger corporations I had heard mentioned, Millennium Healthcare, Silver Age, and the Endeavor Group. Somehow I had the feeling things were beginning to snowball for Joel Glazer and his partner Harvey Brodus. I started with the assessor's office in the county administration building, where I looked up the property tax records for Pacific Meadows. As expected, Glazer and Brodus were listed as the owners. Under their individual names, I checked for other properties they might own and made a list of those. I left the assessor's office and walked over to the courthouse to the county recorder's office. Files there were arranged according to the grantor and grantee indexes, those who sell and those who receive. I spent an hour working my way through real property sales, grant deeds, trust deeds, tax liens, quit claims, and reconveyances. Tina Bart had been right. The Pacific Meadows building and lot had changed hands 3 times in the past 10 years, and each sale had represented a substantial jump in price. The property was sold to Maureen Peabody in 1970 for $485,000. She'd sold it in turn to the Endeavor Group in 1974 for a tidy $775,000. The property sold again in 1976 to Silver Age for $1.5 million and was finally purchased by Glazer and Brodus's company, Century Comprehensive, in 1980 for a whopping $3 million. By calculating the documentary transfer tax on the grant deed, I could see that the current assessed value was $2.7 million. I crossed the street to the public library and started working my way back through the city directories, looking for Maureen Peabody. Moving back and forth between the city directory and the crisscross, I discovered she was the widow of a man named Sanford Peabody, who'd been an officer at the Santa Teresa City Bank from 1952 until his death in the spring of 1969. Maureen had probably used the money she inherited from his estate to buy the nursing home. On a hunch, I returned to the courthouse and checked the marriage records for 1976 and 1977. In February 1977, I found a record of the marriage license issued to Maureen Peabody and Frederick Glazer, a second marriage for both. She was 57 at the time, and he was 62. It didn't take much to figure out that Maureen was Joel Glazer's stepmother. I was betting Maureen's name would appear again among the corporate officers of both Endeavor and Silver Age. The only question remaining was, who owned Genesis, the operating company for Pacific Meadows? I found the company listed among the applications for registration of a fictitious business name. The owner of record was Dana Jaffe, doing business as Genesis Financial Management Services. The mailing address was in Santa Maria. For her home address, she'd used the house in Perdido where she'd lived at the time I was looking for Wendell Jaffe. Joel Glazer had probably talked her into signing the DBA application before they married. She may or may not have understood the significance. On the surface, Genesis appeared to be separate and unrelated to Pacific Meadows. In truth, Glazer controlled both, which put him in the perfect position to reap the benefits of all the bogus Medicare claims. I was glad I wouldn't be around when Dana found out she was married to another crook. She was pissed when I helped to put her son in jail. Wait until she had to forfeit her life in Horton Ravine. I left the courthouse, blinking at the hazy light as though emerging from a darkened theater. I glanced at my watch. It was now close to noon, and I was curious what was going on with the police investigation. I deducted the 2 additional hours' work Fiona had authorized. I then went by the bank and withdrew the $975 I owed her. I crossed Anaconda and walked along Floresta to the walkway where the Arcade Sandwich Shop was located. The takeout window was open, but didn't seem to be doing much business. The picnic tables and benches were still way too wet for use. As I passed the plate glass window, I caught sight of Odessa sitting by himself at one of the small marble tables. The place was empty except for him, though the funky indoor coffee shop across the way was jammed. I waved and went in. I sat down in the bent wire chair across the table from him.
"How are you doing?" he said.
"Well, I've been through worse. I thought you'd be doing takeout and eating at your desk today."
"Too depressing. I need light. Fluorescent bulbs make me want to kill myself."
He was working on another paper-wrapped burger in a red plastic basket surrounded by fries. "At least you're eating well." Odessa smiled. The damp air had added a halo of frizziness to his already unruly dark hair. Any woman in his position would be despairing, trying a succession of hairsprays, gels, mousses, and anti-frizz products. Paglia had it right. He shaved himself bald. Odessa gestured at the fries, fully expecting me to take one. I shook my head. "I'm fine. I've just been nosing around in the public records. It looks like Dr. Purcell's business associates have been working a Medicare scam and trying to push the blame off on him."
"You're talking about Glazer?"
"And Harvey Brodus. Purcell had figured it out and had a meeting scheduled with the FBI. Who knows how far the two of them were willing to go to keep him quiet? What's the coroner have to say?"
"He found powder tattooing on his right temple. He didn't have much to work with, but he says it looks more like near contact than a contact wound. Means the gun was held a short distance away instead of pressing right up against the skin. Purcell could have done it himself if his shooting arm was another 8 inches long. They went back to scour the area near the reservoir, but so far no bullet. I think they're going to broaden their search. Could be he was shot somewhere else and then the car was moved."
"That'd be tricky, wouldn't it? With him sitting at the wheel?"
"That bugged Jonah, too. You know him. He got to thinking about that blanket Purcell had over him. Mohair, pale green. He asked Crystal, and she said it was a gift from her. A year ago, she put together this emergency road kit in case he ever got stuck. Snacks, flashlight, bottled water, first aid supplies, all of which he kept in the trunk of his car. Blanket was part of that. Jonah thinks the killer could have spread it over the body and then sat on his lap to drive him up to where we found the car. The blanket was used to keep the blood off his clothes."
"Well, that's pretty cold-blooded. Wouldn't the mohair leave fibers on the killer's pants?"
"Sure, blood traces too. But there's been plenty of time to dispose of the evidence."
I picked up a French fry, doused it in catsup, and put it down again. "I talked to Crystal last night. She came across his passport in an overcoat pocket from the last trip they took. What about Polly? What's the story on her?"
"Jonah had me check on that after you talked to him. She got picked up the first time when she was 13. Grandmother thought somebody stole her car, so she called the police. Turned out Polly took it. She also got picked up once for loitering and once for malicious mischief. She's a kid with too much time on her hands and not enough supervision."
"She and Leela are sure trouble."
"We're still working on that. We sent someone down to the school to see if we can get a match on the date she was off campus and the money being pulled from the ATM. Those girls go any place but home for the weekend. They have to get permission from a parent or guardian, plus an okay from the person they intend to visit. It's already looking like she managed to play both ends against the middle. Not easy to do. School officials have seen every trick in the book, but she's smart. We've subpoenaed the bank records and the records from the mailing service where he kept the post office box. The DA and probation are talking to the judge this afternoon. We're hoping to wrap that up."
"Here's something else. The other day I stopped over at the Horton Ravine house. Leela had left school without permission. Crystal was having fits and gave me permission to search her room. She's got a locked metal box hidden under the mattress. It's probably dope, but it might be the missing money. She and Polly may be planning to take off. You might be smart to keep an eye on them."
"We can do that," he said.
I got back to the office at 1:15. The rain was picking up again, and I was tired of it. A curious depression had descended in the wake of the shooting with the adrenaline rush that accompanied it. The subsequent crash was accelerated by my conversation with Odessa. I envied them the hunt. Jonah Robb, Odessa, and Jim Paglia. Purcell had been murdered, and though they might not be any closer to finding out who killed him, the process was underway. I sat at my desk and I stared at the leaves on my fake ficus plant. From halfway across the room, the accumulated dust resembled a light layer of talcum powder. One day soon, I'd really have to wipe that down. I swiveled in my chair and picked up a pencil. I drew a box on my blotter. I spent the rest of the afternoon catching up on all the chores that I'd been putting off for the past week. I typed up the information I'd unearthed about Genesis and made photocopies of Clotilda's bills, adding as much of her chart as I thought reasonable. I was hoping no one would ask how I acquired the medical data. While I stood there at the machine feeding in copies, watching the light on the copier go back and forth, I pondered Fiona's request for the $975 in cash. That was probably a simple explanation. I didn't think she was seriously concerned my check would bounce, so it had to be something else. The picture that kept coming to mind was her weedy hillside property. I visualized the front hall of her house with its decor of drop cloths and permanent scaffolding. I was also brooding about that green mohair blanket Crystal had given Dow, about someone sitting in his lap after he'd been shot to death. You wouldn't want to drive far, certainly not out on public roads, where a pedestrian or a driver in the next lane might look over at just the wrong moment and spot you in the dead man's embrace. If you were the killer, you'd think about the reservoir. How nice it would be if both the dead man and the car disappeared from view. Jonah had been assuming the killer made an unfortunate mistake, miscalculating the position of the boulder, which prevented the car from being fully submerged. What if the reverse were true? Maybe the killer intended to have the car found. If Dow's death was meant to look like suicide, then maybe the casual error went the other way. The killer knew the boulder was there and thought the car would still be visible when daylight came. Instead, the vehicle veered slightly and sank too far down to be seen easily. It wasn't until late afternoon that I opened my bottom drawer and hauled out the phone book, turning to the yellow pages under the section that listed painting contractors. There must have been 100, column after column, some of them with box ads, some with catchy sayings. Don't paint yourself into a corner when you can let us do it. Charlie Corner and Sons Painting. I had a quick vision of the Corner family sitting around the kitchen table, tossing back shots, coming up with log lines to stretch the advertising budget. I started with the A's and ran my finger down the names until I found the one I remembered from Fiona's sign out front. One line of print, Ralph Triplett, Colgate. No street address. I made a note of the phone number. Fiona struck me as the sort who'd pick a lone operator, somebody too hungry for business to argue with her. She'd bypassed all the splashy half and full-page ads. I dialed Ralph Triplett's number. I was going to cook up a ruse, but I couldn't think of one. The phone was picked up on the first ring. Ralph Triplett Painting. I said, "Hi, Mr. Triplett. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I just finished doing some work for Fiona Purcell up on Old Reservoir.
I hope you got your money up front."
"That's why I'm calling. Is she a slow pay by any chance?"
"No pay is more like it. You seen that place of hers? White everywhere? You think that'd be simple enough, but we've gone through 6 shades so far. Everything from frost to alabaster, eggshell to oyster. Couldn't find anything to suit. I'd get half a wall up, and then she'd want something else. Too green, she'd say, or get the pink out of it. Meantime, I haven't been paid in weeks. The architect filed a lien against the property, and I'm threatening to do likewise. Meantime, I finally got around to checking her credit. Should have done that in the first place, but how was I to know? She puts on a good show, but she's busy using one credit card to pay off another. What'd you say your name was?"
"Doesn't matter," I said, and hung up. I pulled out the rubber-banded packet of index cards. This time, I didn't add anything. I shuffled back through my cards, checking the information I'd picked up in the past week, particularly the details about Dow's last day. In passing, Mrs. Stegler had confided an item that caught my attention in light of everything I'd learned since then. She said that while he was out at lunch, Fiona had stopped by. She'd waited in his office and finally departed, leaving him a note. I'd sat in that office myself, and I know how easily she could have opened his desk drawer and taken his gun. Driving up Old Reservoir Road in the gathering dark, I could feel myself in a state of suspended animation. The only sign of agitation was that I was taking the curves a little too fast for the current road conditions, which were wet, wet, wet. I had an idea, an intuition to verify before I called Jonah Robb. I turned left on the road that angled up beside her property and pulled into the parking area behind the house. I went around to the front door and rang the bell. She took her sweet time coming to the door. I stared off at Brunswick Lake. In the waning light, the surface was as silvery as mercury. It had been 11 days since I first stood in this spot, looking out at the same sweeping views. The steep, sloping lot was now a fairyland of knee-high weeds, foxtails, wild oats, and rye bending in the passing breeze. With much more rain, the now softened hillside would slide down into the road. The door opened behind me. Even babysitting for her grandchildren, Fiona was decked out in a black wool suit with big shoulder pads and a pinched-in waist. The lapels and jacket cuffs were done in a faux leopard print. She had her hair concealed in a matching leopard print turban. Gloria Swanson had nothing on her. I held out the envelope. "I included an invoice for your records. I hope you don't mind signing for the cash." "Of course not. Won't you come in?" I stepped into the foyer. There was a tricycle in the hall, and the floor was covered with the same sort of kitty detritus I'd seen at Blanche's house. Tinker toys, blocks, a sock, broken crackers, crayons. The kids had built an enormous tent with the painter's drop cloths, which were now draped over all the chairs in the living room. I could see them bumping around in there, erupting in the sort of harsh, artificial giggles that signaled the prelude to a big, stinking fight. Fiona scribbled her signature on the receipt. Her fingernails were dark red. She wore the same shade on her lips. She had a smudge of lipstick on the surface of her two front teeth. The effect was odd, like a virulent attack of bleeding gums. I tore off the top copy and handed it back to her. "How's Blanche doing?" "She's fine. At least she's had peace and quiet for the afternoon. Andrew's picking the kids up after supper tonight, assuming we live that long. Mind if I use the bathroom?" "There's one off the kitchen. You can help yourself." "Be right back," I said. Fiona returned to the living room, and I could hear her issuing orders about the cleanup. The kids even seemed inclined to cooperate. I walked through the kitchen and unlocked the door leading into the three-car garage. It was dark outside, and the yawning space was gloomy. There was a BMW parked in the nearest space, but the other two were empty. She'd told me when Dow came to visit, she made him pull into the garage each time so the local tongues wouldn't wag. I flipped on the overhead light, which didn't help that much. I took the flashlight from my shoulder bag and crossed to the far wall. I imagined myself sitting in Dow's silver Mercedes. I looked to my left and calculated the trajectory of a bullet fired from the front seat, through the driver's head, through the car window, and into the wall. Right about there, I thought. I'd have bet money she never bothered to pry the bullet out of the drywall. She'd had enough white paint on hand to cover any evidence of what she'd done. Who'd even think to look here? The cops with their metal detectors would be scanning down the hillside as far as the road. In the light of the faulty overhead bulb, the wall appeared to be smooth. I ran a hand lightly over the finish, expecting to feel the faintly irregular patch of plaster fill. The wall was unblemished. Not a mark anywhere. I shone the light on an angle, hoping for the roughness in the surface to jump into bas-relief. There was nothing. I made a circuit of the space, but there was no indication whatsoever that Dow had been shot to death here before the car was moved. No fragments of glass, no oil patches on the floor where his car had sat. I stood there, astonished. I wanted to wail with disappointment. This had to be right. I had been so sure. The door to the kitchen opened and Fiona appeared. She stood and stared at me. "I wondered what happened to you." I looked back at her, mouth suddenly dry, desperate for an explanation that would cover my behavior. "Detective Paglia was up here earlier doing exactly the same thing. He checked the walls for a buried bullet and found none." "Fiona, I'm sorry." "I'm sure you are." She paused a moment. "One question, please. If I'd actually killed Dowen, why in the world would I hire you?" I could feel my cheeks grow warm, but I knew I owed her the truth. "I thought you needed to have the body found to collect on the insurance. If you hired me, you'd appear to be above reproach." Her gaze bit into me, but she never raised her voice. "You're a very arrogant young woman. Now get out of my house." She withdrew, closing the door behind her with a sharp report. I let myself out. I got back in my car and started down the hill, reeling with shame and embarrassment. What defense did I have? I'd been wrong about her. I'd been wrong about Crystal and Clint Augustine. I'd been wrong about Mariah, who made a fool of me. I turned left at the intersection. I'd driven a block when I caught sight of a familiar figure walking backward along the side of the road. Polly, with her thumb stuck out. Jeans, hiking boots, the same black leather jacket I'd seen her in before. Nice quality leather, too. And I wondered if she and Leela had paid for it with a portion of the stolen $30,000. I slowed and pulled over on the berm while she hurried to catch up. By the time she reached the car, I'd opened the door for her on the passenger side. "Hop in. Are you on your way to see Leela?" "Yeah, she's staying down at the beach." She got in and slammed the door, smelling of dope and cigarettes. Her hair was brown and straight, and might have been shiny if she'd kept it clean. I could see raindrops like sequins sprinkled among the strands. She had unconventional looks, but there was something haunting about her eyes, which were large and dark brown. "You can let me off in town. It's no problem finding a ride from there." "I don't mind driving you. I could use the air," I said. I waited for passing traffic and then pulled onto the road. "You're lucky I came by. I'm usually not over in this area. Were you up at Lloyd's?" "Yeah, but he was out and I couldn't find a key. I didn't want to wait for him in the cold. Aren't you sick of this fucking rain?" I let that one pass. "The two of you are friends?" "Kinda, because of Leela." "How's she gonna feel about it when he moves to Las Vegas? Think she'll miss him?"
"Big time. She was really bummed when she heard."
"Is she back at school?"
"Not until Wednesday. Her mom's driving her down."
"Well, maybe she'll get to visit Lloyd once he's settled," I said. "When's he taking off? He said a couple of days."
"Something like that. I'm trying to talk him into taking me along."
"You'd leave town?"
"Well, sure. I don't give a shit about this place."
"Don't you have family here?"
"Just Graham is all, and she wouldn't care. She lets me do anything I want."
I looked over at her. "Have you ever been to Las Vegas?"
"Once, when I was 6.
A smile lit her face, and her expression became animated.
"We stayed at the Flamingo. Me and my sister swam in the pool and ate so much shrimp cocktail she barfed in a bush. After it got dark, we went around and finished all the drinks people left on the tables." "What a blast. We were acting like nuts. We couldn't even walk straight."
"I didn't know you had a sister."
"I haven't seen her or my mom since."
I was curious about that, but I had already asked a lot of questions and I didn't want her to think I was interrogating her, though I was, of course. I'd have a hard time with the heat.
"I like it. Even in summer, I bet it wouldn't bother me a bit. I could leave there easy. What a hoot."
Seems like money would be a problem.
Not at all. I have lots.
I could hear her hesitate, pondering the slip. Clearly, she told me more than she intended.
I could probably get a job parking cars at one of the big casinos, something that paid good tips. This guy I know says a parking valet can make up to 100 a day.
I thought you were 16.
Everybody says I look older. I got a fake driver's license says I'm over 18. Nobody checks. As long as you show up for work, what do they care?
She thought she had street smarts, but her notions of how the world worked were wishful thinking on her part.
You think I don't know how to take care of myself?
I'm sure you do.
I'm fine on my own. I'm used to it by now. I'm living on the street half the time anyway, so better there than here. Maybe Lloyd'd get a place and I can live with him.
You think that's appropriate? She gave me an indignant look.
I'm not banging the guy. He's just a friend.
What will Leela do if you leave? I thought the two of you were inseparable. What I was really thinking was how easy it would be for Lloyd to tuck the girls in the car with him before he left the state. I didn't believe Polly would go anywhere without Leela. I glanced at her and watched her struggle with her response.
That's her problem. She'll figure it out.
We reached Crystal's beach house. I pulled into the gravel parking area and Polly got out. I didn't think Crystal would be glad to see her, but she'd probably be polite. I figured Leela and Polly, inseparable as they were, would end up in jail together within the next few hours. So much for Vegas and her fabulous career as a valet car park. I left the engine running, waiting while Polly rang the bell. I noticed the house next door had a sale pending banner, now affixed to the for sale sign. Crystal came to the door. If she objected to Polly's presence, she seemed to keep it to herself. Maybe Leela was easier to get along with in Polly's company. Crystal caught sight of my car and waved. I returned the wave and backed out of the drive, my headlights washing across the open carport where I could see the Volvo and the convertible. The slot on the extreme left was empty, and I was guessing that was the spot where Dow had kept his car. I felt a tiny jolt of electricity. I made the turn onto Paloma Lane, drove half a block, and then pulled the VW over to the side of the road. I got out and walked back to the house. As I moved into the drive, my footsteps crunched on the gravel like someone chomping on a mouthful of ice. Crystal had closed the door, and the area was dark. I could smell ocean. I could hear the pounding of the waves. The quiet was like nectar wafting through the still night air. The rain had left the heavy scent of seaweed, pine boughs, and solitude. I swear the very dark had an odor of its own. Dare to be stupid, I thought to myself. Some people think you're stupid anyway, so what difference does it make? As I had at Fiona's house, I placed myself in a spot that approximated the location of the Mercedes front seat, picturing the car parked as it would have been had Dow pulled in that night. Maybe Crystal had promised him sexual treats, spelling out the possibilities in such succulent detail that he'd bypassed his scheduled visit with Fiona and come home to his wife. He must have pictured her coming out to meet him in a flimsy nightgown, something diaphanous, a thin, silky fabric that the ocean breezes would lift flirtatiously, exposing her legs. Crystal knew how to use her body to good effect. She could have retrieved the Colt Python 357 on an earlier occasion. She told the cops Dow kept it in his desk at work or in the glove compartment of his car. She had access to both, especially with Griffith's visit to the nursing home. Even if she appeared wearing sweats and running shoes, all she had to do was open the car door, lean across the seat, and kill him as sweetly as a kiss. Driving the body up to the reservoir was a nice piece of misdirection. The risk of being spotted on the highway apparently less important than this chance to put Fiona in the soup. Given the amount of money Fiona stood to gain, the police would naturally pursue the notion that she'd killed him herself. I looked to my left and calculated the trajectory of a bullet speeding in that direction. After all, if a shot had been fired from a Colt Python across the space of the front seat and through the kindly doctor's head, One could only imagine the bullet traveling right on, smashing the car window, crossing 10 feet of space, and plowing through the shingle siding of the house next door. I crossed the patchy stretch of grass that lay between the carport and the structure next door. It might have once been a detached garage, joined to the house now and converted to a guest wing or family room. I took out my flashlight and turned it on. I moved the bushes aside and swept the beam across the rough-hewn shingles. The bullet hole was big, as black as a spider sitting on the side of the house. I retraced my steps across the gravel parking pad to Crystal's front door. I rang the bell. She opened it a moment later with an expression on her face as if I might be someone soliciting for charity or selling door to door. She said, "Oh, I didn't expect to see you. What's going on?" "I'd like to use your phone." She seemed puzzled, but stepped back and let me pass in front of her. She was barefoot, wearing sweats, her hair pulled up on top of her head. She peered out. "Where's your car?" "It's parked on the road. The engine cut out, and I need a way to get home." "I can do that," she said. "Hang on a minute, and I'll grab my keys." "No, no, please. I wouldn't want to trouble you. I have a good friend nearby, and he's an experienced mechanic. I'll just ask him to take a look. Maybe he can fix it right there and send me on my way." "Well, if that doesn't work out, I can always run you home." From upstairs, I could hear the thunder of music being played at top volume. I pictured Polly and Leela planning their escape. I really hoped the cops would show up before they made good on their getaway. I wasn't sure where Rand was. Maybe off in the bathroom, getting Griffith ready for bed. She showed me into the den and then stood in the doorway while I took a seat at the desk. I smiled at her briefly and said, "This won't take a minute," hoping she would leave. I picked up the receiver and dialed Jonah's home number. If Camilla answered, I was screwed. On other occasions, she'd left the receiver on the table and walked off, refusing to tell Jonah I was on the line for him. When the call was picked up, he said, "Jonah Robb." "Oh, hi, it's me. Kinsey?" He sounded puzzled, as well he should have. "Yes, it is." "What's up?" "I'm at Crystal's beach house. I've got a little problem, and I'd love to have you take a look." "All right," he said cautiously. "I'm buying this. Like what?" "No problem. I can wait. Is that convenient for you? Because if it's not, I can always try Vince." "Well, you know, I'm right in the middle of something. Is this important?" "Completely. You have the address?" "I know the place." "Are you in trouble?" "Not yet, but I could be. I'll see you shortly, and thanks. I appreciate this." I replaced the receiver, and when I looked up again, Annika had joined Crystal in the doorway. The two stood close together, Crystal in front, Annika slightly behind. Annika's hand was on her arm, and I suddenly understood what I'd been looking at all along. Annika said, "Is there a problem?" "Not really. I'm waiting for a friend of mine to come give me some help. I had some trouble with my car. He'll be here in a bit." "Oh, well, why don't you join us for a glass of Chardonnay while you wait?" "I guess I could do that." I followed them out onto the deck. We sat in the dark, just the three of us, sipping wine and chatting, listening to the surf rumble on the beach, until Jonah arrived. This is Judy Kaye. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of P is for Peril by Sue Grafton. This program was produced and directed by John Wager. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2001 by Sue Grafton. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.